criminal charges against cops who murder our people. The third thing we need to do is limit qualified immunity so we can bring these 1983 actions against cops who were bad and departments who allow them to be bad. And the fourth thing we need to do is we need to have a national database for law enforcement officers who commit bad acts. Right now, you can murder somebody, get off, go two cities down, and get rehired. That is not the way this should be. And those are tangible solutions that I don't want to wait till November for. I want people to put pressure on their local officials and government right now to do those things. Mm-hmm. And every mayor, every governor...
We have to leave it there. But we are certainly going to continue the discussion. Bakari Sellers, attorney, author of the new book, his memoir, My Vanishing Country. Dr. Corna West, professor in practice of public philosophy at Harvard University, and Kianga Yamata Taylor of Princeton. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. You're listening to...
You're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
It is where I am. It's a bright, sunny morning, so that makes it at home.
Yeah, it's bright and sunny for me too. It is. I'm thankful because today. It's kind of a stressful day, and I'm sure listeners, it's either been a stressful or a frustrating day, one in which all of the anxiety that we've been experiencing the past few weeks, even months, is compounded now by pressures from a whole different area of life, and that is... feeling that the safety and sanctity of life is as equal value to you as it is to other people. And so with that in mind today, Cecil and I thought it was really incumbent upon us to have a conversation about what's going on, to try to establish some measure of comfort between ourselves, that we see the value in each other, we want to support the value in each other, we want to walk toward each other with patience and compassion and, yes, a measure of humility, because as we see in the signage everywhere, we are all in this together, and we're not going to come out of it if we allow ourselves to be divided. Just like it's been said by many a leader, united we stand and divided we fall. And in these spasms and painful throes that we've been experiencing, which are both political and social and racial in nature, we're being tested. We're definitely being tested. And so today we thought we have a conversation about the protests, about the sentiment, about the anger, the pain, and the frustration around the death of George Floyd and the struggles and attacks of many other Black Americans in the past. Just this past year, it's been more than we can stand.
And George Floyd is one person who's been killed by law enforcement this year, and that's Celeste suggested. It's only one. Unless we become satisfied with ourselves and our town, we also need to remember those in our towns who have been attacked and killed by law enforcement. So while this morning we are drawn together by the trauma experienced by many of us by the killing of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor, we also need to remember those others who have suffered, and the family and the trauma of that continues to be a daily experience by many. I'm reminded of Fannie Lou Hamer, who said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." And that's the feeling of many these days.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in Points East along the Columbia River Gorge, and in Points South, the Willamette River Valley, 104.3. You can hear KBOO everywhere worldwide at KBOO.fm. Good morning, everyone. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Celeste Carey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Cecil Prescott, here. The phone number so that you can join in the conversation is 503-231-8187. And we ask for your patience, because as we are doing it remotely, our esteemed engineer, Ty, will put you in, and then you can join in the conversation, but we can only take one call at a time, so this calls for a measure of patience from everybody. I know that can be hard, but it's our reality for right now. So join in the call and join us in conversation as we try to at least find some measure of comfort through communication, through conversation, through compassion and care. And that's one of the joys of community radio, that we get to have this kind of dialogue without fear of interruption by commercials. You know, this is your chance to call and try to, I don't know, reach out and connect, make some sense of it all.
So a question for you today is the question that many of us are asking. How are you today? How are you feeling? I want to also direct your attention to our page on KBOO, where we posted a couple of links that might interest you. One is from a selection that's in the that was in HuffPost by a writer, Candace Halsey, and it's a personal reflection, and it's titled, "I Am an Angry Black Woman. This is What I Want White People to Know."
Yes.
And also we posted a link to a poetic, actually it's a sermon by the Reverend Otis Moss III from Chicago Trinity United Church of Christ, and it is entitled "The Cross and the Lynching Tree: A Requiem for Ahmaud Arbery." Those are just two reflections about some of the things that are going on, but as Celeste suggested, we want to hear you and your thoughts.
We have Camilo on the line. Camilo.
All righty. Good morning, Camilo.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, I mean, I'm breathing. I see the light. you know, I'm thankful for God getting me up another day, but I am depressed. I'm not broken, but I am battered. I'm tired. You know, and at my age, I can imagine people older than me are worn out too, and I too feel like Fannie Lou Hamer. It's like, I'm just so tired of being tired and sick of being sick of all of this. But, you know, like all of my family before me, you have to keep on keeping on.
Yeah, I think everybody is being impacted by this trauma that is just sort of unrolling and revealing all of the hurts and pains and frustrations. Now, I had surgery a month ago on my back, and I'm still in pain. I can barely walk. I can hardly stand up. But my spirits have been high, and it's only just until the past few days, actually since yesterday, that I've begun to recognize that I'm beginning to get a little anxious. I'm beginning to get a little worried because of what I see in the media. I'm not leaving my home. I'm 78. I'm black. I'm highly vulnerable, and I'm safe and comfortable here in my home. But I'm not going out to any protests or demonstrations. You can believe that. But what I see is kind of the breakdown of the people who are generally united on the left. I've been an activist in this town for 10 years, and you know, I think I'm familiar with most of the older generation of people who have been activists. And now it's fine. The young people are taking over, taking their role. They've got a lot more energy, a lot more courage to take risks. But what I'm reacting to, and I want to make my comments very narrow, is a post in Facebook where a number of people were critical of Joanne Hardesty for supporting the stop people from going to the street, curfew, that's the word, sorry. So you know, I can understand that there might be some political reasons for taking that position, but I want to speak as a black person. I'm not speaking as a black leader. I'm not a black leader, but I've participated in the black struggle all my life. And I'm concerned that the direction taken by some of the younger, more aggressive protesters is not going to do anything for the black community, and it's going to put the black community at risk. I think when these sort of tactics are employed, the ones that are going to suffer the consequences are the poor and black people in this town.
This is a nuanced situation, or rather, it calls for a nuanced response. And my question is kind of along the lines of yours, and I want to say this to the white young protesters, many of whom I saw on TV up and down the coast in Seattle, here in Portland, breaking windows to places like Starbucks and running out with cups or running out with Louis Vuitton bags. Exactly what does that do for George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor? What does it do for them that you broke a window to a store and you ran out with a cup or some piece? You know, that's not what we're marching for. And in that, the anger and the frustration that's come down through the generations and manifested something that Dr. Joy Leary calls post-traumatic slave syndrome, that's not in your DNA. You know, it doesn't help. And so in many ways, I understand exactly what Joanne was saying. This is not helping our cause at all. If this is what you're here for, go home.
You know, I just want to say, and this is really the last thing I'll point out, is that protests, being in the street, clearly is a essential task that we have as a united group in solidarity. But the leading principle has to be nonviolent civil disobedience,
Without that, everything is going to fail. And if you are old enough and you remember 1968 when there were a lot of protests, what did that result in? That resulted in Nixon. So remember that.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
So that's really about all I have to say. So keep on keeping on, girl.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Thank you for bringing up a really important point, is that we can overcome, but this, you know, the violence is what we're experiencing. That's the cycle we want to break.
Well, Camilla, I hope you are well and that you heal well, and thank you for your thoughts. You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. You may give us your thoughts to 503-231-8187. Unless this becomes, I have a couple of thoughts from what I heard from you, Celeste, and Camilo, in terms of critiquing some of the things that are going on in the streets. One thing, I think we have to be careful about the narrative and the language we use, and one recognize that nonviolent civil disobedience is civil disobedience. It is interrupting the mainstream. It is saying no. It is putting a wrench into the war machine, into the machine of racism. And it means putting your lives on the line. Those who are engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience are not being passive. They will be, and they have been called terrorists, as interrupters, as those who destroy and disrupt the things that are. So it is not a path. It is not a way in which one will prevent destruction or critique of who you are. It may be for some a tactic, it may be for others a lifestyle, but be assured that it is a way in which you attack, deny, and delegitimize the political and civil order. And you will be, as those who we now memorialize, attack, criticize, and yes, indeed, kill. One need only look at the memorials of civil rights martyrs in this nation. Secondly, I think we also need to be aware and cautious of how we critique those who are engage in interrupting the civil society these days. Those of us who are older must also recall how when we were younger, we were those who were criticized by our elders because of doing that which we see many people are doing these days in the streets throughout this nation. So we need to be aware of that. And then also, as Camilo pointed out, all of us, young or old, need to learn from the lessons of those in the past. This racist, violent society is not something that developed in the last 20 years. In this nation, indeed, it has a 500 year history. And so, it shows itself in different forms throughout. So this is a long process, and that we need to continue to learn from those before us. But also, as Camilo and Celeste suggested, we need to, again, be aware of the lessons from the past and find ways in which we can unite in the struggle to resist dismantle this racist society.
We have Robbie on the line. Robbie.
So that's my sermon for right now, but let's go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning, Robbie.
Good morning. How are you all?
Well, we're here.
Right, yeah, we're still here, still going. I wanted to bring up just some, maybe a perspective that might be able to help, which I see going on. I find it frustrating when it gets brought back up to the violent protests that have erupted, because it's like somehow trying to outweigh the violence, which is why we're protesting. And in the scheme of things, it's like whether or not, you know, obviously you heard that there was the Minneapolis police officer who was suspected of sabotaging that AutoZone. Have you heard of that?
There's only so much one can listen to. I don't know. I haven't. I have to zone out every now and then so I can keep my sanity.
No, I get it. And just, I guess there was some video of an individual who got identified as a Minneapolis police officer. I won't say his name, but if you look it up, I'm sure you could find it posted all over. His ex-wife is the one who actually doxed him because it was her gas mask that he was wearing. And this is nothing new. You know, Asian provocateurs, there's actually video evidence of a Portland police officer in the 2016, when Portland was getting burned down from Trump's election. But so this is obviously nothing new. And you know, with the provocateurs, people come dressing up, you know, and smashing a window. And, you know, next thing you know, everything getting stolen out of there. But what frustrates me is that, and even with particularly Joanne Hardesty, I mean, you know, and I listened to her on X-Ray earlier this morning. She got interviewed by Jefferson Smith. I just don't see how this considered as – I don't see how this is considered as violence, first of all, considering, you know, they torched – you know, in Minneapolis, they torched a police precinct that was empty, you know, and we smashed – you know, here – there was a smashed Apple store, and it's like that's releasing insurance claims, which is going to get people, you know, money.
Let me stop you here, Rob, because this is my feeling. Yes, I heard what Cecil said, and I understand, but exactly how is that, and especially when it's not necessarily black folks or folks of color, exactly how is smashing all these stores getting the attention to a man dying?
Well, sure. Let me
and people going into the houses. You know, when you know something Cecil said when we were talking about this last night is, you know, our esteemed mayor, when he came back, he didn't meet with aggrieved parties of the black community who were suffering, you know, from the fact that they too have either lost somebody due to this state-sanctioned violence, but he met with the business community first. And to me, that sends a different signal. That sends the signal that it is profit over people.
Well,
and when I hear people talking about breaking windows and what have you, you know, I understand people sometimes that's what it comes to, but these are people who are breaking buildings, but they're not there to support in other ways, or if they are, they're not necessarily visible. And so to me, that's like wasted effort. That's like a dilution of the rage. So I help me understand why breaking these buildings actually makes a difference. Why? What does that say to all of these people who have been shot or even just harassed like Mr. Cooper was in Central Park trying to look at some birds? How does this help it?
Well, I think you missed my point, which is that...
Well, no, I heard your point. I don't understand why it's relevant. So that's why I'm asking you to break it down rather than say it again.
Well, okay, yeah, but I mean, if I'm going to have to break it down, that's saying it again. But basically, you have people who Portland police has dressed up as Black Bloc. They lit off fireworks at a particular protest I was at before. And when there's this video evidence I have, I tried giving it to OPB, and I showed them and I told them about this. At first, the OPB reporter, the journalist, was like really skeptical that Portland police to dress up as black bloc anarchists and go light off fireworks. But then when I showed her the evidence, her jaw dropped. And then she goes, you know, my colleague found that they were doing this at, you know, some, it was like a Patriot prayer and thing in Tigard. And she right. said she caught Portland police dressing up as police officers. So my point is that unless we fix why we are protesting, there's going to be more protests, which means there'll be more provocateurs, which means there'll be more white people, which you're complaining about, which are breaking and looting. And unless we address the problem, that's going to be a reality of these protests, because there really isn't getting away from that. Actually, when I was out last night, I felt I saw at least three people who were known Patriot Prayer fascist people dressed up exactly like everybody else, all 10,000 people. And so that's going to happen. And me being an observant and somewhat, you know, intelligent individual and having watched a lot of these rallies throughout my life, that's going to happen. So I think the question should be asked is, like, how, at what point does that business matter? And to hear your to what you said with Ted Wheeler about the you know, he went to go meet with the business, I think that shows his priorities. I don't think that's what I'm saying.
But I'm also thinking that I hear what you're saying about how there's a lot of rage because there's provocateurs involved. But that actually takes away from our whole point about this conversation. We're not talking about necessarily just the riots. We're talking about the fact that black people are stressed because black people are killing us. We're getting killed. They're killing us. And I do care about the fact that the protests are being co-opted, but that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm talking about pain from a whole different area.
My point was, is either you're going to blame the protesters or you're going to, you know, focus on what we're
I'm not blaming on the we're not talking about that today, Robbie. We're talking about the fact that there is no way in Black American consciousness that we feel safe. You don't feel safe in your home. You don't feel safe sleeping in your bed. You can't sit on your sofa and eat ice cream in your own apartment. You can't answer your door. If they say put your hands up, lay on the ground, you can put your hands up, lay on the ground, stretch your legs and feet out, you still get shot. I do know that the protests have meaning and they are a response, but right now I'm not talking about the protests and how they're being infiltrated. I'm talking about the pain that a lot of us are feeling about the fact that we still keep getting assaulted and killed and denigrated. And while, like I said, while your point is made and I heard it, and we do have to be concerned about people diluting the message, corrupting the message, co-opting the message, right now that element of the protest is not what I'm talking about. I do appreciate
your
call.
Okay, well, let's take it from this perspective.
Go ahead.
Where is the violence in a broken window compared to the people that were, you know, out here in the streets trying to get justice for? If it's going to be something that takes it away, it's the very notion of you saying that it takes it away. And this idea
Robbie, this is you talking like a white man right now, not trying to hear my point. I'm talking about pain that's been for generations from a system that needs to be destroyed, but there are other ways. And as Cecil mentioned, there is this thing called nonviolence, and it did work, and it has value. And right now, you're trying to press a point instead of hearing me express some generational emotional pain. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you're missing my point.
I'm actually a Mexican, all right? And I'm actually the victim of police brutality from Arizona. Because of a white racist cop.
Okay, why are you talking over me? I did listen to you. Why are you talking over me?
Because you told me I was a white person, so I wanted to say I'm actually Mexican, and I've also been a victim of police brutality in the state of Arizona.
Okay, well, as a Mexican person, we have one thing in common, and that is we're both Native Americans. So I want you to channel that and focus on dealing with some long-term generational pain right now, and we're trying to talk about how we can come together and soothe some ragged nerves. And right now, talking about smashing is not doing the job. So I appreciate your concerns, Robbie, but that's not Cecil Taggart.
The peaceful protests that they were trying to do by taking a knee, people also complained about. So as far as I can see, we're either going to be pointing the problem at why we are protesting in the systemic racism that you feel, that I can obviously see. I moved up here to Portland, and it's funny. I changed to a white guy all of a sudden. But in Arizona, I was a Mexican. The cops treated me like that. You know, other people knew that. But what I find just sad is either we're either going to blame the protesters and get caught up on a broken window, which I don't think is very violent, or we're going to, you know, focus on what it is we're protesting. And I'm not trying to say that we need to go smash windows. I'm saying we're going to lose focus by the very notion of being like, oh, what good does this do? That's what the news tells me to think.
What does your heart tell you to think? What does being of Native American / Mexican ancestry tell you to think?
It tells me to defend why it is we're out here, even when agitators and police dress up and start the violence. Because we need to stay focused on the message, and that's what's important to me. And that's actually what I do at these events. I actually go out there and I try to word it, and I try to make it so that way people aren't getting caught up on a... There's actually a really interesting time. I was in Seattle on May Day, and somebody threw a cinder block through Walgreens, and OPB was there. And the journalist for... Or it wasn't OPB, but it was NPR. Some journalist for NPR was there, and she goes, how does this help the cause? How does this help your anti-capitalist march? And I go, look, that's Walgreens. That's the neighborhood drug dealer on every corner taking people's millions of dollars from people and getting them addicted on opiates.
So at this point, I'm going to thank you for your call and ask you to make room for somebody else, please.
Okay.
And you are listening to More Talk Radio here on your radio station, community radio station, KBOO. Our phone numbers here are 503-231-8187. We are talking about what's happening in our world and how we are dealing with it. Our start-off point is the continued lynching of black people by law enforcement and how we resist. Your reflection about how you are doing, your reflection on how the resistance is taking place are welcome. 503-231-8187. And
Dave is on the
speak
line.
From your heart and share your thoughts. And Ty, who's our next caller?
Dave is on the line. Dave.
Good morning. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Good morning.
Hi. You, ma'am, you spent way too much time on that last call.
I did, didn't I? I was trying hard. I don't know what to say, Dave. I was trying to be generous and compassionate and slow the anger. What can I say?
I know.
I wasted you all's ear time. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll be quick, as quick as I can. I'm of color. I'm an African American. I have two cousins in law enforcement. One is now the mayor of Inglewood, California, just to be clear of who I am. That's for the police. I want to talk about, I want you to give me at least a quarter of the time that you gave him to talk about this, because this is hard what I'm going to say.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Brenda Braxton knows what I'm about to say is true. Okay? The media from Channel 2 in Portland, the media from Channel 2 to Channel 12, as far as the news groups are concerned, practice and engage in daily visual subliminal racism. That is a scientific fact. And I would just like to say that we need to acknowledge that when you see black people equated with dogs, and then someone goes on TV and says, they shot him down like a dog. Well, half of that is a correct subliminal statement, because we don't shoot dogs down in the street. We do, however, look at dogs as something lower. And the last time that was that it was really hard to watch TV was when they took an African child that was born on Christmas. This is in the month of March of this year. And they equated him to a litter of African puppies without a word. It was a nice little jump from the African baby to an African litter of puppies, a litter of African puppies. So I would just like to say that it's crazy, honey, but it's true. And this is where this microscopic racism, this microscopic aggression, this sixth grader attitude from a lot of racist people in Portland come from. And that's all I want to say. I love you. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. You know, that was something that was brought up at a rally that they had yesterday at Self Enhancement Inc. And I can't remember I don't remember exactly who it was. I won't call names. But one of the speakers called out the media because they would focus on the young black folks coming out of the stores with merchandise and run that same piece over and over again in the loop. And it's not the first time we've dealt with the media being complicit in Portland's particular brand of racism. But I don't know, what are your thoughts, Cecil? You've been quiet.
Well, I think it's important, and I appreciate our caller pointing that systemic racism is not isolated. By definition, is systemic, and that
indeed.
Media plays a role as well in contributing and as part of the is part of the destructive machine, and that's why we need to certainly have a critical eye and be aware of the role that we our institutions play on maintaining and promoting systemic racism. And we need alternative voices, and we need a critical eye on how we view, how we read, and the resources we go to. It's so important to be aware of those things. And again, as you suggested, and as the caller suggested, we need to look critically at these things and to critique them.
We have Joe on the line.
And yes.
Joe.
Let's go to Joe. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joe.
Sorry.
Hello.
I had a moment there with the child.
That's okay.
I appreciate your remark about thinking critically. And I have a lot of feelings and have been following, you know, the different sides of this question around property destruction, but then also the narratives that surround what is going on. And just on Democracy Now, toward the end of the hour, one of their guests kind of spoke to this question of the narrative of outside or just minority, not minority in the usual sense, but like just a small group of people being the provocateurs doing this. And that it's very suspicious that the cops and that the politicians want to lean on that narrative, because it helps delegitimate not just the protest because people think that it shouldn't be violent, but that it delegitimates the rage and the depth of the demand for change and the exasperation with how peaceful protest has not brought about change. And I just wanted to put that into the conversation and what you all think, or what else you have heard to the effect of that. It's been said that on the one hand, property destruction delegitimates peaceful protest, but we also see that riots and uprisings are not peaceful, and that there is something valid in that breaking of the peace, because it's a false peace to begin with, and that the attempts to build a narrative around that give give those watching or listening somebody to be angry with and separate that forceful action from the people who really have something to complain about is itself what helped delegitimate that. And I'll take response off the air.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you sharing that thought and the reflections from the from Democracy Now. A couple of thoughts for me, and I'm repeating something I said earlier. One is that resistance, whether so-called nonviolent or violent, is resistance. And that so-called, this narrative where we talk about peaceful protester and how it's better, for me at least, is who is saying that and what does that mean? Nonviolent resistance is resistance. Peaceful protesters are protesters. They are seeking to dismantle a system of illegitimate power and seeking to put it down. And there are no protesters who have so-called peaceful, who have been embraced by the system. If you are embraced by the system, then you are not, I think, doing your job of resisting the system. So whether or not we want to sanitize the civil rights movement or other movements in the past, going back, those people were attacked and criticized by the powers that be. They were thrown in jail. They were shot at. They were killed. So it's not, for me at least, we have to say, be aware that the powers that be will delegitimize any protest.
That's proof that, yes, I agree.
And that is important to be critical and thoughtful about how you protest. Now, there's no way for me you can compare a broken window with the killing of a person. They're not the same. And that it is important to continue, regardless of how you seek to bring awareness, to go back to the issue of this racist, corrupting, systemic authority that we are combating. And how do we seek to dismantle it? How do we, one, bring awareness to it? And that's what protest is. You're bringing awareness, shining a light that things are not right. And what are things we can do to offer a different world?
We have Corey on the line.
Some people are more thoughtful, and maybe Corey is. Good morning, Corey.
Hey, good morning, you guys. Long time no hear. I'm glad you guys sound safe. I don't want to take up too much time, but I'll be brief. I understand Celeste's frustration. Trust me, I think we're both veterans, and this is a country that I serve. So to see sort of what's happening, well, it's been happening. I think that every once in a while, a spotlight is shined on it. But I'm also in a sort of perverse way sort of grateful, because when situations like this happen, you get to separate your allies from the people who you thought were your allies. I've seen a lot of people that I thought were my friends on social media. They kept posting the image of MLK standing hand by hand at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, stating, this is the type of protest I like. What they refused to show is, like, after that, after they were standing hand by hand, they got their butt kicked. They won't. They'll show one part of the story, but they won't show the other part. So I find that to be odd. And like I said, that you got allies, and I pointed it out. I followed back, but also I can also block people. But I also think that what's happening in this country, and this, we drove from Houston, Texas. We're currently in a place known as Lummi Island, Washington. We drive through a pandemic because And I think I've mentioned my thesis that I don't think that we were meant to thrive in this country. They built this country on a lot of erroneousness on the basically the backs of one people and the genocide of another people. So if an empire is going to fall, and if you look at just the imagery of the President of the United States in his bunker with the lights out, that's the leader of the free world is hiding out because he doesn't want to deal with this. But then, I also think he's a symptom. 62 million people voted for this man knowing that he was nothing but a racial arsonist, blatantly ignorant. And so there are a lot of Americans that actually want this. When we talk about property, and when I see men with armed rifles, outside of a Starbucks, yet they won't stand up and protect a black man from getting a knee on his neck to death. That tells me that, like the caller, a couple of callers before, the dehumanization of the black male form, and I don't mean to disregard black females, but I think specifically the dehumanization of the black male form, I think, is inbred in certain elements of American culture. I am happy that they're, and I say happy in a, like I said, I'm being very perverse. I am happy they burnt down that Sisters of the Confederacy.
There are a lot of protesters who are tearing down Confederate memorials in this anger that they're feeling.
Exactly, I don't try to put myself into the mix. I knew of George Floyd. We used to work security together in Houston. I worked with him a couple times back in the day. So for everything that I knew about him, he was just a nice man, one of those quote-unquote gentle giants. And of course, what they're going to do now, they're going to start digging up information about him to basically make it seem like, well, he's in some way, shape, or form, by being a black man, he deserved this. And even if he did have they said he might have had a fake $20 bill. Well, right now, people are in a position where they got to do what they got to do to save their families.
Right. So,
that's true. That's true. What do you mean? Well, that's not a killable offense anyway. That's not an offense that he should be killed for. And then, I mean, what happened to the possibility that he didn't know it was counterfeit?
Well, even if he did.
But,
oh, wow.
Yeah, true.
But even with that, that's a crime. But it doesn't matter if it was counterfeit or not. It doesn't matter what we do. We could be like Bossum Jean sitting in our house eating night cream. We could be like Tamir Rice. Whatever it is, they will find a way to justify to destroy that black male form. And I've grown up, so have you guys, just the apathy to the black male form, I find it to be... it's as American as apple pie.
Yeah.
Well, yes, and that's sad but true. I mean, one of the things that I want people to know is that we have to be on guard because, this is the one thing that Robbie said that I really wanted to accentuate. This was a good point that he brought up, is that there are provocateurs, and we need to be aware of that. But I'm only going to say that in this regard, there are people who are frustrated that it's taken so long for Black America to rise up, and they're looking for a way to start a civil war. And if you read any of the propaganda or material that's put out by a lot of these white supremacist groups, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get the battle on, so to speak. And one wonders sometimes with all these spates of killings and the killing of George Floyd, it almost looked premeditated. That's one of the things I think that upsets people, that the man sat there with his hand in his pocket and his knee on the neck, and knowing that that had to have some effect on him. And when he's hearing that, he decided that him even being handcuffed was not enough restraint. And so that's the other part, is the fact that, like you said, the human aspect of black men is denied and denigrated, and people are just people are having that spasm of pain. I don't condone.
Well, I also want to pick up on that point that you made in terms of the black male form and the dehumanization that takes place. It's historic. It's part of the American narrative.
Yes, it is.
Africans were enslaved. We can remember in every generation. In the 1955, Emmett Till, 14-year-old black boy. In this century, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black boy. And it doesn't matter how old you are, it's the image and that continued narrative that continues throughout American history, the denigration of the black male body as seen as some sort of threat. It's systemic and it continues from the birth of intentional use of this term from the birth of this nation until today.
And I don't want to take up, I like to talk to you guys, but in just one quick point, like they mentioned the gentleman in Central Park, even if you do everything you're supposed to do, this man was a Harvard graduate, bird watching, he's pretty much, once again, the perfect black victim. Yet you have to be perfect to be a black man and a victim. He was perfect in every way. And look what she did. She weaponized her whiteness to try, as far as I'm concerned, try to get that black man killed. So whether you're a thug or you're a Harvard graduate, you're still black and you're still a threat.
Right.
Yes.
And that, I mean, that's a perfect example for me in terms of how you can consider a threat. And so, Paul, thank you for pointing up. It doesn't matter who you are or whether or not you fit a certain class, you remain a threat. We remain a threat.
I love you guys. Talk to you guys later.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. So I've noticed that I hadn't heard from any of the women out there, and we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to touch on something and just kind of have you say it again. This whole idea of what legitimizes and delegitimizes a protest. Because you said it pretty succinctly, and I thought it bore repeating.
Okay. I think in part in terms of protest remains protest, and how how protest is viewed is also depends on where you are standing. Protests, I think others have pointed out, our last caller just pointed out, so-called peaceful protest remains peaceful. And if you consider a threat, no matter how so-called peaceful you are, you will be attacked and you will provoke a response. And indeed, that's part of the message of nonviolent civil disobedience. You want a response so that the world can see to delegitimize the system. But we also have to be aware of how we term things. A peaceful protest is better than not peaceful protest. Protest remains protest.
We have Ross on the line.
And it's not a way in which to lift up the system. But let's go to our next caller.
Well, good morning. Hello.
Good morning. Hello.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes. It's good morning. How are you all doing? I can tell it's a very trying time for all of us. And I just want to share first just a personal thing. It's a little bit humorous for me. But I once went into a tavern, and I reached in my back pocket, and I pulled out. I was sure I had a $100 bill in my back pocket, and I handed the $100 bill to the bartender, and she looked at it a little bit, and as they always do, she said, "This is counterfeit." And I was so shocked. I'd just come from the bank where I got the But it turned out that my the clothes I was wearing were from Goodwill, and this was something that had been through the laundry several times, and so it was obviously counterfeit. But I did have a false $100 bill, and of course, I was thankfully in a bar where they knew me. I don't think anybody would have made a big deal out of it. They saw it was obviously counterfeit, and it was an accident. But that isn't why I called. I wanted to say that I had the good fortune yesterday of actually coming upon the demonstrators who were walking down Stark from in Southeast Portland, and I think it's wonderful they were doing it in Southeast Portland instead of down Martin Luther King. But it was a wonderful group of diverse people, especially a lot of young people, emphasizing that this entire nation is outraged. We have to look at. I was so glad to see all these healthy young faces, and they were not smashing windows. They went past Music Mamoya, and nobody stole a record or a tape. It was a beautiful group, and how that the beauty of this wonderful spontaneous outrage that has happened is taken over at the end of the demonstration by this group of wildcats who have somehow got the notion that they're going to take care of the violent eye for an eye and break windows, and they get all the publicity. And so all that beauty of the protest has been outweighed, and we were caught up in that. But I want to say that beautiful to see this this outpouring, the beautiful part. But let's look at the other thing. The thing is that this is a very problematic place for all progressive people, and it was covered very nicely years ago in a book by Franz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. It was a psychological discussion of the problem of rebellion and colonial peoples and oppressed peoples. But he called, there's a whole chapter, The Pitfalls of Spontaneity. Well, The Pitfalls of Spontaneity, he's really drawing attention to a kind of nationalist rebellion, which would be cultural revolution as opposed to political revolution. The Pitfalls of Spontaneity are the organization of tribes who allied with South African apartheid, because they wanted to gain a leg up against another kind of tribe. In other words, it's spontaneity is a problem. We have the rebellion in Libya has got rid of Gaddafi by this wonderful spontaneous uprising, and we've got something so much worse. We do have to respond to something that's outrageous. It's what happened, how horrific in Minneapolis.
Ross, we're almost out of time, Ross.
Okay,
thank you.
I'm going to write my thoughts and share them with you.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you, and God bless you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, you so know, much for sharing your story and bringing up Franz Fanon. Yes, Celeste.
I was just going to end with referencing something with the article that we shared in Huffington Post from Candace Howells is her name. The article is, "I'm an Angry Black Woman, This is What I Want White People to Know." And in some ways, it's kind of hard to structure a conversation like this because people's feelings are all over the place. And sometimes we want to get to a certain point, and we want to have people hear a cogent point. But I would really refer people to the article. One of the things that was in this article is racism exists because white colonists decided hundreds of years ago to dominate a land full of native people and kidnap people from another continent, to work mercilessly without any pay. And every turn of events since then, every snippet of progress has been twisted to maintain that whole economic and social hierarchy to exist and existed the day America became America. And the question is, you know, not so much how you protest or what's right or what's wrong, but the issue would be, how do you connect? How do you connect? And whether you are white or Latinx, Latin American, or Asian, or Native American, if you're looking to join this fight, this fight is just pretty much the beginning, she says. There's going to be conflict. It's worth it. It's long haul. But you need to take this battle into places where we don't have any influence. You need to make this your priority. You need to be angry. You need to be dissatisfied. But you know what you need to do? You need to pull up your people and talk to your people and check your people. And if you're thinking, I'm not racist, I'm not prejudiced, I'm not biased, she says, you are on some spectrum. It doesn't matter how well-educated people are. We've seen that. It doesn't matter where you are. You can be in your bed asleep, and somebody breaks in your house, and your partner pulls a gun, and then they're accused of attacking an officer. The fact is, until we get our white allies, our indigenous allies, you know, all of our allies, to be outraged and take it to their people, it's not going to make a big difference. Close, Cecil.
Thank you so much, Celeste, and thank you, Candace Howes. And so thank you for joining us. Continue to be outraged, continue to stand up for justice as we remember those who have been lost just simply because they are. We remember Breonna, we remember George, we remember Ahmaud, and the countless others in this